that I have for today. So I'll ask our very next speaker, who will be joining us, to turn on his camera so that I can share his video with all of you and provide a quick introduction. So again, we're going to be joined by Kent Glover, who is coming from the U.S. Air Force Civil Engineering Center. Dr. Glover has been involved in groundwater and vadose zone remediation since the early 1980s. He's currently the Air Force Subject Matter Expert, or SME, for remediation systems and provides technical leadership in remedy selection, implementation, performance evaluation, and optimization. He also provides expertise in numerical modeling of contaminant fate and transport and remediation of non-aqueous phase liquids. So Kent, I know that you have some welcoming remarks to share. So I think I'm going to turn it right on over to you, sir, so that you can begin the session.
Thank you, Jean. I want to welcome everybody that's attending the webinar today and hope you come away from this webinar with feeling that you learned something and contributed as well. The title of the webinar, I don't remember if Jean mentioned that, is FRT Art 30 Years, Grand Challenges and Opportunities for Advancing Remediation Technologies. And I just want to make a few comments. It's a somewhat unusual format that we're going to follow today and next week during the second session of the spring meeting. When FRTR stood up about 30 years ago, the senior leadership of our agencies recognized the need to exchange technical information and challenges and identify common ground and advanced remediation technologies. And so a charter was prepared, and it's been pretty much our guide for the last several decades. It served us well, and I think we've done some good things. But the world doesn't stand still, and now our understanding of contaminants is evolving. New contaminants are on the horizon, and we've come to recognize that many of our sites and cleanup challenges are highly complex. Agency funding priorities have changed, and even the way we communicate and share information has changed radically in the last 30 years. This webinar is one example of that. But our need to share technical challenges and identify common ground and collaborate to advance technologies hasn't gone away. It's actually probably increased. And so it's appropriate for us to go back to our senior leadership, and that's what we've done today, and try and refocus the organization on today's challenges and the challenges that are on the horizon for each of our agencies. We all have a unique perspective, but at the same time, we all are trying to seek common ground on how to address these technical challenges and meet the needs of the agencies, and to collaborate in advancing our understanding of the technology and technology transfer. So what we have for a format today and in a week from today is as I say, somewhat unusual and a deviation from past recent years, where we focus on a single technical topic usually. Today, if we could go to the next slide, that brings us to some meeting objectives for both today and a week from today. And they're listed here. I can read them off, but you can read them just as well. Today, we're going to focus on trying to understand what the agency's challenges are, what the needs are, what the role of FRTR might be in addressing those challenges and that kind of thing. And so we have a panel of distinguished senior level leaders of our agencies who have been very willing and gracious to participate in that discussion. And Greg Gervais will be moderating that in a bit. A week from today, session two, we'll focus more on advancing ways that FRTR can help the agencies to advance technology and promote technology transfer and information exchange. So I hope you look forward to that. Before we get started, slide number three, please, or whatever the next number is. 10, I guess it is. Okay. I want to acknowledge the FRTR Steering Committee. This has been a really a real effort to put this this webinar and the one in a week together. There's a lot of moving parts, a lot of people with lots of schedules and conflicts, and it's been a tremendous effort. But in general, the steering committee has over the years really proven to be the heart and soul of this organization, and this organization couldn't do nearly what we have been able to do without them. So I want to just list them here. You can read them off. You can see which representative of your agency is on the steering committee. It's a really, really good group to work with. They really personify the mission of this organization. When we meet, they leave their ego at the door and listen carefully to one another, even though they come from agencies. We all come from agencies with different perspectives and needs, but really, we really listen to each other and really seek to find that common ground and find a way that we can collaborate and move forward. And it's just a real pleasure working with these people. So I want to acknowledge them, particularly for this meeting, the spring meeting here, the two webinars. I want to particularly acknowledge Heather Henry from NIEHS and Tanya Gallegos at the USGS, who have led the effort of planning and preparing, and there's just a lot of behind the scenes work that has gone into what you're going to see, and I hope you appreciate it. I certainly have appreciated what Heather and Tanya have done, so thank you. And I think with that, what I'm going to do is, Gene, I'm going to pass this off to our first speaker of the day, who is Tom Nicholson. Tom is the Senior Technical Advisor for Radionuclide Transport and the Environment, Division of Risk Analysis, Office of Nuclear Regulatory Research at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. He's been with NRC for about 44 years in a variety of technical and project management roles, emphasizing training and some research work. He's holds BS from Penn State in geology and a master's in hydrogeology from Stanford. He's a registered professional geologist, a professional hydrogeologist, a member of AGU, GSA, and several other professional organizations. He has been a member of the FRTR steering committee for many years now, and has really been an asset to that organization, that group. The thing you need to know about Tom really is that if you have the opportunity to work with him, you'll come away from the experience better for it. And I think your work product will be better for his input and his participation. He's just a real pleasure to work with. So Tom, with that, I will turn it over to you. And Tom is going to talk today, help us focus really on what our goals are here today in this webinar. The presentation is entitled Introduction to Grand Challenges Session. Tom.
Thank you very much, Kent. Those are very kind words. I really appreciate the discussion that you've had up to this point. I want to acknowledge that. Kent is the co-author, along with Dan Powell, who's chief of the Technology Integration and Innovation Branch. At our November 18th meeting, Dan Powell presented a talk on FRTR 30 Years, a Retrospective of Applied Innovative Technologies for Successful Site Remediation. Next, please. So the Office of Technology Innovation at EPA was founded to implement the 1980 Superfund Law Act and its amended act. And the advocates for this new technology for Superfund cleanup sites focused on contaminated soil cleanup, groundwater assessment remediation, a very important topic, decision support tools for decision making, optimization tools, and nanotechnology. Next slide, please. So after the Office of Technology Innovation was founded, Walt Kovalak and his colleagues at EPA established the Federal Remediation Technology Roundtable in 1990. And as I said earlier, if you go to the FRTR website and look at last meeting, you can go into a lot of the history and the details. But basically, the organization was started by EPA, DOE, and the Department of Defense Services, Air Force, Navy, and Army. And it was to look at innovative technologies for a cleanup and remediation. Next slide, please. So the members, as Kent mentioned, are the Department of Defense Services, Army, Navy, Air Force, EPA, DOE, and its labs. And DOE has done a remarkable job in the area of radionuclide transport cleanup. The Department of the Interior, Department of Transportation is a new member. NASA and the USGS, ourselves, the NRC, and of course, the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. Next slide, please. So one thing I wanted to focus on that would help you, the listener, is to go to the FRTR website. And if you go to the website, you'll see that not only is there a tremendous amount of information here, but it's also interactive. If you go down the left side column, you'll see technology screening matrix. This is an interactive, friendly tool for screening potential applicable technologies for remediation projects. The matrix allows you to screen 49 in situ and ex situ technologies for either soil or groundwater remediation. Variables include in screening include contaminants, and there's contaminant classes of halogenated and non-halogenated volatile organic compounds, semi-volatile organic compounds, fuels, inorganics, radionuclides, munitions, and emerging contaminants. Their development status of these new innovative remediation techniques, the overall cost, cleanup time, in-depth information on each technology is also available, including direct links to the database of cost and performance reports written by the FRTR members. Next item down, cost and performance case studies. The member agencies of the FRTR have worked together to make data widely available on real experiences and lessons learned in selecting and implementing treatment and site characterization technologies to clean up soil and groundwater contamination at hazardous waste sites. The remediation case study reports describe the performance and cost of technology applications at full-scale and large-scale demonstration projects. Next one. And finally, I'm going to talk about decision support matrix. Next item down. This is a website provided to allow you to have access to a tremendous amount of software tools that can be used as part of a structured decision-making process for environmental site cleanup. Modeling is one of those items, and we developed just recently a publication, a bibliography on guidance for modeling of subsurface contamination remediation sites. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. A companion website is the CLUIN, the cleanup information website. This is extremely valuable because it provides direct access for training. And when we have had FRTR meetings in the past, we've identified some of the best presentations and created special FRTR Presents seminars and discussing remediation strategies and initiatives and identify these training opportunities. So this is also a very important website for you to go to and find out more. It describes it's a clearinghouse of the technologies, contaminants, issues, strategies, and initiatives, the technology developer tools, and training and events. Next slide, please. So when you look at the source of the contamination, there are a variety of remedies. And one of the things in the circular decision documents, there's both in situ and ex situ treatment of the source itself. And this has advanced dramatically over the years. Next slide, please. So with regard to the groundwater remediation strategies, initially, one of the most popular, 97% of the technology was pump and treat. But as you can see over the years, these methods, which were innovative at the time of the beginning of the FRTR, now become more common, commonly used. And so we have both in situ treatments, bioremediation, thermal treatment, a variety, and then monitored natural attenuation has become also an issue that people have been thinking about. And DOE has developed an enhanced monitored natural attenuation approaches. Next slide, please. So what are the priorities that we have identified for, you know, the FRTR and where we would like to begin thinking about changes? And one of them is, of course, is the technologies have developed over the last few years at improving conceptual site models of understanding the site and the configuration, both natural and engineered, and how that system needs to be characterized and modeled. And also following up on optimizing remediation and maybe a series of remediation techniques, not just one. Then what are the emerging techniques for site characterization treatment of emerging contaminants? I talked two sessions ago, dealt with PFSAS, and which is becoming a very important issue at many sites. We also want to look at advances in site characterization remediation technologies for heavy metals and radionuclides in soils, sediment, surface, and groundwater, including those used at mine sites. And then what kind of mutual understanding of subsurface modeling and visualization capabilities and limitations? This is also evolving. And then, of course, what are the web-based strategies for improving technology transfer among technical experts? You can read about this. It's on our 30-year anniversary fact sheet at the FRTR website, and I give you the address at the bottom. Next, please. So for today's session and on the 26th, we thought about having a special FRTR meeting asking the senior leaders of the FRTR member agencies, what are their grand challenges that your agency faces regarding remediation over the next decade? Specifically looking at contaminant source and site characterization, emerging contaminants, and remedy resilience under evolving climatic conditions, what are your agency's remediation technology needs or research gaps for those three items? And are there other key issues not captured above? So that'll be today's session. We'll be focusing on those questions. And then on the 26th, next one, please. Next slide. We want to think about advancing new technologies. What are the main barriers for advancing application of innovative remediation approaches from your agency's perspectives? Do you have recommendations for overcoming these barriers or incentivizing new technology application? Are you aware of any promising new remediation technologies on the horizon? We're also looking at innovatives and coordination. The initiatives, are there strategic remediation initiatives, programs underway at your agency for advancing site cleanups? Are you aware of resources, opportunities, or other groups that would enhance FRTR's coordination efforts? And finally, what is your vision for the future of the FRTR? What do you see as the key value of FRTR today for your agency? And what would you hope to see FRTR accomplish over the next 5 to 10 years? Next slide, please. So the meetings for today and on the 26th will be looking at responses to these questionnaires that were sent out. They were formulated by the FRTR Steering Committee and sent out to all the member agencies. So today we're going to go through those responses and have a coordinated panel discussion. So to lead us in that discussion, first we'll talk about the responses we got in a summary sense, and that'll be by Tanya Gallegos. Tanya is a research engineer at the U.S. Geological Survey in Reston, Virginia. She received a PhD in environmental and water resource engineering from the University of Michigan. She is a registered professional engineer in the state of New Mexico. Her research encompasses inorganic geochemistry, naturally occurring radioactive materials, NORM, water use in hydraulic fracturing, environmental impacts of uranium mining, and waste as a resource at abandoned mines. Tanya?
Thank you very much, Tom. As Tom mentioned, I'm going to be discussing today the questionnaire to senior leaders of the FRTR member agencies that was sent out. Next slide, please. And so rather than looking at specific responses, I'm going to be talking about some common themes in the responses that were generally given across the different agencies. And so the two questions that I'm going to be talking about today are, what are the grand challenges facing the agencies regarding remediation over the next decade? And the second one is, what are the technology needs and research gaps that are related to those challenges? And those fall under three different categories. The first one is contaminant source and site characterization. Next, emerging contaminants. And finally, remedy resilience under evolving climatic conditions. Next slide, please. And so we also want to hear from you on some of these questions. And so you have two options to share your responses. You can submit your own responses to these questions, specifically on the grand challenges and technology needs and research gaps, using the Q&A feature in the live webinar today. You can submit your responses anonymously if you prefer by clicking the appropriate box on the question form in Zoom. And secondly, you can also send in your thoughts by email to frtr@emsus.com. And so all of these responses are requested by May 31st, 2021. And these responses will be used to assist in planning future FRTR reports and activities. Next slide, please. And so let's move on to some of the responses from our senior leaders from U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Department of Energy, Department of Interior, EPA, NAVFAC, NIEHS, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and USGS. Next slide, please. And so these are some of the grand challenges that were commonly reported amongst the different agencies. The first one is climate change and climate resiliency, and specifically how these factor into long-term remedy decisions. Emerging contaminants were also cited as a challenge. And specifically, you know, how do you characterize, clean up, and assess the risk associated with these emerging contaminants? Large, complex sites are often difficult to remediate and pose a great challenge. And it could be possibly due to some of the features that are exhibited at these sites. For example, low permeability zones, complex groundwater subsurface hydrology, and also recalcitrant contaminants could be an issue. Technology selection and use of flexible strategies is also a challenge. And many agencies also suggested that limited resources may pose a challenge in the future as they do now. There's always limitations of current cleanup technology that need to be addressed to improve technology as emerging contaminants come to the forefront. And finally, training new personnel is always an issue. You know, transferring the knowledge to the newer generations joining the workforce is of concern to our agencies, including the RPMs. Next slide, please. And so now let's turn our attention to some of the related technology needs and gaps. And these again fall into three categories. The first one is emerging contaminants. And so some of the technology needs and research gaps include the need for toxicity and behavior data to better understand how these contaminants could impact different aspects of cleanup. In some cases, interim guidance is necessary as well. And this speaks to the need for expanded research, and better understanding these contaminants can lead to better methods for sampling these contaminants, analyzing them, as well as treating them and implementing the remediation technologies. Next slide, please. Okay. So the next category is the contaminant source and site characterization. And some of the technology needs and research gaps here include cost-effective characterization at an appropriate scale, especially for these very large complex sites. Secondly, there's a need for conceptual site models, dynamic CSMs, if you will. And these could be really useful tools when you're designing different remedies. And this will give you an understanding of how these sites can change over time as the remedies are taking effect. There's also a need for technology to reduce the source of the contaminant, as well as possibly robotic sampling methods. And these can be useful, especially in cases where some of these sites are very difficult to access. And there's also a need for improved inventory of resource extraction sites, for example, abandoned mines, and also their features. And a better understanding would lead to better implementation of remedies for cleanup, as well as cost analysis. There's also a need for improved understanding of the necessary balance between models, assumptions, and field data. So how could we extract better assumptions regarding a site based on what we measure in the field is very important. And there's also a need for improving sensors. And so this could lead ultimately to better real-time monitoring, which could be useful for understanding how effective these remediation schemes are. And finally, there's a need for improved subsurface characterization tools. Next slide, please. And our final category is remedy resilience under evolving climatic conditions. And some of the technology needs and research gaps that were reflected in the questionnaire responses include the need for treatment and containment strategies that can weather these changing climatic events. And in some cases, there's a need for developing more complex models that capture the different facets that affect a field site. For example, the need for integrated climate, topographic, geologic, geophysical, hydrologic, and biologic models of watersheds could potentially lead to better assessment of cleanups at the sites. There's also a need for better prediction of future climate conditions in different regions across the United States. There's also a need for example, better understanding of sea level rise on remedies near shorelines. And finally, there's a need to better understand how renewable energy can play a role in some of these remediation technology implementations. And so next slide, please. And so I hope all of this information can give you an idea of some of the responses that and challenges that are facing our agencies today. And so next up, you'll get to hear specifically from each agency's senior leader, and they're going to be talking about their perspectives of remediation challenges over the next decade. And so each panelist will provide a brief overview of their agency's mission, remediation programs, and highlights of agency challenges and priorities. And this session is going to be monitored by Greg Gervais. Greg is a National Program Manager for the Environmental Protection Agency's Federal Facilities Superfund Program and the Director of EPA's Federal Facilities Restoration and Reuse Office in the Office of Land and Emergency Management. Greg is responsible for national policy development and oversight for over $8 billion in annual cleanup at the federal facilities, at different federal facilities around the country, including 175 national priority list sites. His background in chemical engineering and licensure as a professional engineer has led him down a long and distinguished federal career path, not only with various programs within EPA, but also with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And with that, I'll turn it over to Greg.
Thank you, Tanya. As Tom Nicholson indicated in his remarks just a few moments ago, May 2020 marked the 30th anniversary of the FRTR. When the roundtable first met in May of 1990, it involved senior program managers from federal agencies with responsibilities for cleaning up hazardous, toxic, and radioactive waste sites, and with significant investments in developing and applying innovative options to meet the cleanup program needs. The original FRTR objectives were twofold: to identify common site cleanup issues faced across these agencies, and to identify and share research and demonstration knowledge to improve the understanding across the cleanup industry of the applicability and performance of innovative technologies. The panel session for our virtual spring 2021 meeting split across 2 days, today, as well as next week, May 26th, follows that approach. Today, we will engage with leaders responsible for the program management of the remediation efforts of the FRTR member agencies. And now to our panel session. Each panelist will start with brief remarks about the challenges their remediation or research programs are facing or will face to help guide the FRTR in planning its focus over the next 10 years. The remarks will be followed by a short break, then a round-robin Q&A session, hopefully driven by questions from you, our audience. Next week, leaders of the remediation research efforts with our FRTR member agencies will share the directions they are headed in terms of technology research and development. And with that, let's begin. Dana Stalka is the Deputy Director for the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA. Dana, take it away.
Thanks, Greg. Appreciate it. I was struck by how many of my comments and remarks intersect a lot with what you just said, Greg, and with what Kent and Thomas and Tanya all talked about. And I think it illustrates the importance of us working together on how much better we can do and how much we've proven over the last decades that when we work together, we can really make a bigger difference in for each of our agencies and for the environment as a whole. Next slide, please. So within EPA, the most visible part of our program is the national priorities list. And as you see on the slide, we currently have a little over 1,300 sites that are currently final on the national priorities list. That does not include the 400 to 500 sites that have either been proposed to the list or over 400 that have been deleted from the list over the years, which is remarkable. Example of the great work that's been done. And this does include the federal facilities that Greg's office oversees for EPA. What those numbers do not include is the tremendous amount of work in the other programs within EPA that take advantage of the technologies that we have been able to work through the FRTR in developing over the years. If you look at the RCRA corrective action program, you're talking about over 1,000 facilities there. Underground storage tanks, there's over 100,000. Federal facilities, there's over 10,000. State and private facilities that are not even currently being cleaned up by EPA, there's tens of thousands there. And even within EPA, we have thousands of removal actions we've taken over the years. So it's a huge universe of work that we do for cleaning up the environment and protecting people, but also implementing the technologies that this group has made such a difference. Next slide, please. Some of the challenges that are probably the biggest in many ways and most complex. Groundwater, we have so many sites, over 80% of our sites have some type of groundwater contamination. A lot of my stats will be about national priorities list sites. But again, over 80% of NPL sites have groundwater as one aspect of contamination. We have deleted some of those sites, but a lot of the sites we're still working on. We all know that groundwater is harder to get to. We also, it was talked about earlier that we traditionally had done a lot more pump and treat with groundwater, and we've really moved to more source treatment, but we still, and the timing it takes to get the groundwater cleaned up when you can't get to it directly is long. But the good news is we're making great progress. And in a minute, I'll talk about characterization, which is another area where we have made progress and it's really helped us. As far as mining goes, we within EPA's national priorities list, we have about 140 or so mines or mine processing facilities. But there's hundreds of thousands of abandoned mine lands out there. And they don't all present the same kinds of hazards, but a lot of them do present, whether it's fluid hazards and other types of hazards that we need to deal with and we need to worry about. And so it again is a huge problem. Our program, the EPA Superfund program, only deals with a very small percentage of it, but hopefully working together, we can see which technologies work best. We have done a lot of work within OSREDI, within EPA, in looking at the technologies, working with our Office of Research and Development of what has worked and what has not, looking through literature, talking to project managers, et cetera. We also are investing in some demonstration projects to try to find out what works best, what has the least footprint, in terms of some of the traditional cleanup technologies are effective, but they leave sludge and they leave other disposal issues. So we're constantly looking for, is there a better way to clean up these types of sites? Sediment sites and the dynamics that they provide, and how do you have different multimedia, you have water, you have sediment, you have soil, you have upland sources. How do we characterize what's going on? And then how do we come up with technologies, come up with modeling and scientific approaches to try to protect the environment as best we can? That's a constant challenge. Contaminants, emerging contaminants and emerging science. We've mentioned earlier today, PFAS. These chemicals are getting a lot of attention, and rightly so, in terms of the contamination and the health impacts, but also the challenges with remediating those contamination. 1,4-dioxane is one that we're continuing to try to improve how to address that. Lead is another one that is not a new contaminant, but the science is continuing to evolve. And we're always looking for ways. You can dig up soil, but are there other ways that you can address some of the contamination, some of the exposures that are out there, that we're constantly trying to improve how we can reduce that exposure? I would be remiss if I didn't talk about the intersection between policy and technology. For instance, with lead, one of the challenges that we are looking at more now than ever is the various different pathways of exposures of lead, and how often the same communities have been underserved in many ways and have had to deal with these exposures through the various pathways. And so as we go in and we're looking perhaps under the Superfund program at soil contamination, we also are looking at working with our water program, the air program, our indoor dust programs to see what's the true contamination out there. And we're hoping that not only does that inform what's going on in terms of the exposures, but also helps us determine what kinds of remediations would be most appropriate and what technologies might be most useful. Next slide, please. This is actually getting at what I was talking about, the major focus on environmental justice. There was a recent executive order 14008 that came out and from the White House, and it talked about environmental justice. It talked about climate change, which has been talked about earlier today. And it also focused on redevelopment. One of the things that we, as a overall program, while we're looking at technologies, we realize that one of the greatest areas of success that we've had in terms of overall site cleanups have been at sites where there's a vision for what the site will look like after the cleanup is done. That has really energized communities, has brought things, people, funding, programs, smart people together to try to say, this is how we get to that end goal of the new vision. The technologies is a key part of that. And again, the parties working together is also a key part of it. This feeds into what we think will, where we need to be, is that we are not only protecting everyone, but we're making sure that those communities that have been especially impacted are addressed appropriately. And then ultimately, when we walk away, we not only have a cleaner environment, but we have a better economy, we have a community that is in a better place than they were prior to us entering the community. And that's the goal, and how we bring the technologies, the policies together is really critical. Next slide, please. So remediation technologies are a priority. And over 20 years of optimization, our experience, it tells us that characterization is critical. And I think one of the things that I've learned in my years in the program here is how important it is to be able to look at what's going on, for instance, subsurface, whether it's groundwater or other media subsurface. The better you know what's going on there, the better you can figure out which technologies are going to be most applicable, as well as where, what areas you really need to clean. I know there's been times in the past when our characterization technologies were not as good, and we started looking for contamination in the wrong places, or we spent a lot of money and time digging at the areas that were not as contaminated. So our overall cleanup approach is improved by having a better knowledge of what's going on. Next slide, please. These next couple of slides get into a little bit more about site characterization. I think a lot of you are familiar with some of the tools that have were introduced and were considered innovative at the time, and they still are innovative, but we have a track record that these work. The conceptual site models is just critical in terms of both the characterizing what's going on and also helping us develop a remedy that will work. I've seen some of the most effective examples of that is when we have people working together. Sometimes we have responsible parties who have been willing to work very closely with the state and the federal regulators to come up with an approach that will work for everyone. Ultimately, will lead to the protection that we need to have. Usually, if we're working together, we can find the most efficient ways to do it. And frankly, it's a win for everyone as we're trying to protect people. Next slide, please. I mentioned groundwater. This is kind of a reiteration of what was said before. That's one area that our progress has been incredibly noteworthy and tremendous. As we look at our reports that we've developed over the years around our remedies, this has been the most striking change, where early on we were pumping and treating. And that's good for taking out some contamination. But common sense tells you that if you can get at the source instead of the edge of the source, you're really going to make the big difference. It also allows you to consider other technologies. In my years in the program, I've seen a number of sites where we have gone in and said, hey, let's try this this in-situ technology within a particular plume that had not been tried in that kind of a situation before. It was a technology that had been used in a different situation, but we then applied it to this situation and it really made a huge difference. And so I think what once was an innovative is now not necessarily quite as cutting edge, but the ability to recognize the situations where it can be used is critical. And so I think that's part of our focus, is not only developing new technologies, but also having a better understanding as to where those technologies are most used. Next slide, please. So one of the challenges, or one among the many challenges that we have, I mentioned the importance of the looking at a site as a whole, looking at the various aspects of the site, where the policies, the communities, and the technologies all come together. I think there's also a challenge with some of the emerging contaminants that are not addressed the same way that other contaminants are. So in terms of teeing things up for future work, I think those places, for instance, where PFAS is existing and other contaminants are there, but they do not respond the same way to the same remedial approaches, I think that's a challenge that we have in front of us as we start looking for these new contaminants. So I encourage all of us to think about how to be more efficient then. And with that, I just like the closing thought again. What was innovative before is now more standard. But the only reason it's more standard now is because a group like this group has taken these technologies, has applied it in the field, and has shown the success. So I encourage us to continue to work together on that. Thank you very much. Back to you, Greg.
Thanks, Dana. Our next panelist is Lara Beasley, Chief of the Environmental Division at Headquarters, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, USACE.
Well, hello, everyone. It's really great to be here. Happy 30th anniversary to the Federal Remediation Technologies Roundtable. You know, I've got over 20 years of experience in my career, and I've been listening to CLUIN seminars for the majority of that, and it's such a privilege to be here and participate in today's dialogue. So as Greg introduced me, I'm Lara Beasley, Chief of Environmental Division for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and I oversee execution of about $1.9 billion worth of environmental work each year. And our work really falls into two categories, environmental cleanup and environmental quality. But the overwhelming majority of that almost $2 billion worth of work is environmental cleanup. And our environment is currently at the forefront of many key initiatives from a policy and execution standpoint, some of which have been touched on already. So I'll go through that pretty quickly. And although these initiatives present their own challenges, they also present an immense opportunity for us to further advance our collective remediation goals. Can we go to the next slide, please? So let's start with Executive Order 14008 and tackling climate change. You know, within this executive order, there's quite a few items that my team and I are tracking that's going to impact our work in the future. This includes specifying net zero emissions economy-wide by 2050. And this means that we as an agency and as a federal government have a lot of work to do in designing and engineering solutions that improve our bottom line. Additionally, specifically, it encourages nature-based solutions. And the Corps of Engineers, we are in a unique position with our two primary missions supporting our Department of Defense brethren and other federal agencies, but also in our Title 33 Civil Works mission. And as a result, we have a lot of experience in engineering with nature. And I think there's a really interesting opportunity right now for us to, as an agency, assist ourselves, our DoD partners, as well as our other federal partners in really evaluating the intersection of nature-based solutions, engineering with nature, and remediation. And then additionally, has already been touched on environmental justice issues and making sure that we are looking at the emphasis that's being placed on that. We've been talking about environmental justice for a long time, but it's finally time for us to maybe put a little money where our mouth is on that. Additionally, we're currently strategizing on how we can better posture ourselves to support the administration goals on climate change mitigation and adaptation as outlined in the executive order. So more to come. That's just a lot of my focus these days. So what about some other ongoing initiatives? Has also already been touched on my favorite four-letter word these days, PFAS, or more broadly, emerging chemicals of environmental concern. You know, the defense appropriations for FY 2021 includes an additional $405 million for PFAS remediation across the Defense Environmental Restoration Program, the Base Realignment and Closure Program, and our operation and maintenance programs. So that really underscores the focus on PFAS initiatives, specifically within the Department of Defense. But from a research perspective, we really need PFAS sampling strategies, analytical methods, and quality processes that can help meet site-specific data quality and project objectives. Most of our sites are in the initial characterization phase, but sooner rather than later, and with the amount of money Congress is throwing at us, we're going to be expected to go to cleanup. And we're going to need to be able to quantify that and set up data quality objectives and work with our regulatory community and our wider communities on the cleanup objectives for those sites. Munitions response. I got to talk about munitions response. It's still a big deal. It's still a big part of my portfolio. Geophysical methods for munitions response continue to develop. We need robust systems that are deployable for multiple environments, including underwater systems. We also need quality processes to account for geologic background variability as we look at these new munitions response systems and how we're deploying and collecting that information and continuing to work on what the right cleanup goal is for individual sites. And then finally, in terms of ongoing initiatives, as already has been touched on, complex groundwater sites. They're an ongoing priority for our remediation activities, development of adaptive management strategies and tools for long-term decision-making for groundwater sites continues to take time. And we would like to see processes that will help predict the effective transition point between active remediation and ongoing attenuation, and techniques to enhance attenuation and low permeability lithology. So we go to the next slide, please. So here at the Army Corps of Engineers, we're committed to providing the best available technologies and solutions for all of our partners, but this requires deliberate emphasis on some key factors, including data quality and new standards result in new technology. And developing new technology and defining the necessary quality processes often takes time. We need technologies that have established quality systems requirements as we get those new standards. And then additionally, it needs to be reproducible. We need sites, tests, and trials, and we encourage pilot studies, peer reviews that are developed with the appropriate quality standards in mind. This will build trust with our regulatory community and our public. And this includes being validated by outside entities such as CERTIP, ESTCP, FRTR, and other examples. And then commercially available technologies are much preferred to meet the demands of the numerous sites in our programs. It's really, really hard for us to promote technology when its availability is not able to meet the needs of our programs. And then finally, knowledge sharing is so key. There is value in robust communication platforms such as today's forum to assist in sharing lessons learned. And moving forward to support research, I would recommend close consideration of these key elements to help foster shared understanding and support technological innovations. Can you go to the next slide, please? So just to wrap up, because I really want to defer to the rest of the panel, and hopefully we can have plenty of time for today's discussion. As our future research needs, it will undoubtedly include supporting climate change initiatives. While these initiatives are not fully defined yet for our organization, optimization will be critical to understanding the benefit of these solutions to the overall climate impact. Technologies and capabilities must continue to expand, become more readily available, and cost less. We need to be able to quantify how each technology will support reductions in greenhouse gas emissions and support carbon sequestration in remediation. This will also support cost-benefit correlations of new or developing techniques. Will increased costs of techniques be offset by the benefits that they support? And we also need to champion environmental justice initiatives. This includes reinvigorating studies that evaluate environmental practices and how remediation strategies can support environmental justice initiatives such as the Justice 40 initiative set forth in Executive Order 14008. Through this development, evaluation of nature-based solutions or engineering with nature, as we call it in the Corps of Engineers, should be considered as they relate to climate impact and the goals of the executive order. Additionally, we need to anticipate future and additional needs to determine where these innovations can intersect current and future processes. These include how these technologies are evaluated to ensure quality process and applications to other programs such as construction or civil works or our other partners. Furthermore, as part of these efforts, we need to accelerate progress through partnerships, collaboration, and information sharing, all of which are embraced in today's forum, and I look forward to our continued dialogue. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Laura. Next, we'll hear from Rob Sidora, Director of the Environmental Restoration Division at U.S. Naval Facilities Engineering Command, NAVFAC.
Hey, Greg. Thanks. First, I just want to say, I really appreciate being part of this panel discussion this afternoon. From our perspective, FRTR has been absolutely instrumental in the success of our Navy's cleanup program. Big thanks to the entire cleanup or steering committee for pulling all of this together. We're looking forward to many more years of continued coordination and cooperation amongst our agencies. So thank you very much. Gene, can I move to the next slide, please? I just wanted to provide a little bit of a snapshot of our Navy's environmental restoration program for our active bases, just to provide a little bit of context on where we are. So on our active side, almost 4,500 sites currently within our program, but we've made a tremendous amount of progress to date. So around 3,700 sites, approximately 83% of what we consider response complete, which is really kind of the key milestone that DoD uses to measure progress within our program. That leaves us with about 700 active sites in the program, which I think similar to the Army, are really some of our more technically complicated and costly sites within our program. A lot of the low-hanging fruit is done, and unfortunately, what we have left are by and large, many of the, tougher nuts to crack. Roughly of the 700, roughly 500 sites are currently in active investigation and initial cleanup phases, while around 200 sites we actually have advanced to actually having remedies in place. But I'll talk a little bit more about this later. Unfortunately, many of these remedies we're seeing essentially effectively operating into perpetuity. So these are one of the areas where we need to continually challenge ourselves and really kind of test whether, in fact, we do have the right remedies, approaches, technologies in place to support our cleanup needs there. Bottom line, a lot of progress has been made to date, but there's still a lot of work to do. And I do want to caveat this by saying that this snapshot doesn't even really scratch the surface as far as reflecting some of the work we see coming down the pipe with respect to PFAS. And again, I'll talk a bit more about that in the next slide. But just real quick on the funding aspects. We currently estimate the program to be about a $5.6 billion program. You know, within the Navy, at least on the active base side, we've been pretty fortunate to maintain a fairly level funding profile around $300 million per year, which has allowed us to make, again, the significant progress that we've made. And over the last few years in particular, we've seen actually some fairly significant plus-ups within the program, largely driven, again, by the high public and political concern related to PFAS. So got a lot of challenges ahead of us, but at least for now, we're seeing a lot of congressional and budget support for dealing with those challenges going forward. So, Jean, can I move to the next slide? Great, thanks. Yeah, so as far as some of the bigger challenges that we have within the Navy's program, for sure, you know, as mentioned earlier, emerging contaminants has been at the forefront, and PFAS is for sure on out top of that list. I mean, over the last few years, PFAS has really just been eating our lunch, I think, with many other agencies. You know, with the Lifetime Health Advisory in 2016, you know, the Navy took a very aggressive approach to trying to address any immediate exposure issues. So we've sampled over the last few years hundreds and hundreds of wells. And in any cases where we found exceedances of the Lifetime Health Advisory, we were very aggressive in providing alternative water for drinking water in cases where we have that level of exposure. So now that we've reached the point of really feeling that we have at least immediate exposure concerns under control, we've really kind of moved into really trying to understand the magnitude of the problem that we have. So we've been initiating PSI investigations across all of our installations and to try to give you a sense on where we are. So collectively, I think we're around 4,000 areas of concern that are being evaluated as part of our PSIs across our installations. And at this point, we're anticipating perhaps somewhere around 500 to 1,000 of those areas will need to move forward and advance into full remedial investigation. So just to provide a little bit of context on that, again, in the previous slide, I indicated that we've got about 500 active sites remaining in the program. So going forward, potentially, we're looking at increasing the number of active sites by perhaps two to threefold. So a tremendous amount of work and challenges going forward. Also, you know, with respect to other emerging issues or concerns, we also have vapor intrusion. Beyond, I guess, some of the more policy related issues, specifically related to, you know, understanding the differences between OSHA versus EPA as far as any short-term exposure criteria. From a more technical perspective, you know, some of the things that we've been really trying to focus on in advance are really trying to understand better there are really kind of the different vectors associated with vapor intrusion, a better understanding the vulnerability of some of our buildings, and really trying to advance some better mitigation technologies and approaches to addressing those vapor intrusion issues. Also along the lines of emerging concerns, we're starting to see a lot more of our low-level RAD sites come into the program. Separate from the restoration program, our active base Navy is pursuing what's referred to as historical radiological assessments, where they're evaluating historical operations on our installations and seeing where they may have been operations that have been impacted areas, you know, within buildings as well as potential releases into the environment. In many of those cases where we've had historical operations resulting in releases to the environment, that a lot of that requirement is falling onto the restoration program. Most of our focus here is really kind of trying to better understand risk and making decisions on risk and how to make more site-specific risk determinations, evaluating tools, including EPA's PRG calculators, as well as DOD's tools on ResRat. Again, you know, the goal here is really trying to have a better site-specific characterization as we move forward on these sites. Next big rock is really some of the complex sites. So as I mentioned earlier, largely what we have left are again, some of these tougher nuts to crack. And, you know, largely these are some of our complicated groundwater sites that are remaining in the program. And, you know, many of these sites we have are post-fraud. They have remedies in place, but unfortunately, we're recognizing that we're effectively not going to reach MCLs on these particular sites. We'll in many cases have to operate some of the remedies that we currently have in place in perpetuity. And really what we're trying to do now is really kind of advance different concepts of better understanding, again, risk and making better decisions on risk, recognizing, perhaps different endpoints. I think, for example, some of the work that we're doing with EPA on adaptive site management, it's extremely valuable in advancing some of these sites through the program. On the munitions front, I think this is actually a really good success story with respect to, technology advancement. When our munitions response program stood up in the early 2000s, a lot of investment was made by DoD on advancing and developing new technologies to help us better address these sites. At the time, all we really had was mag and flak. But through those investments over the last, 5 or 6 years, we're actually starting to see a lot of that technology, in particular some of the advanced sensors, classification technology, actually make its way into the mainstream. And really, as Laura said, the key is making that available for commercial use. And so we're finally at the point where many of our contractors have that capability that they can bring to the table and apply to some of our munition sites. I think going forward, the challenge is in the underwater environment. Most of the investment R&D has been made on the terrestrial side. But a lot of shortfalls in really understanding and applying technologies in the underwater environment. We're actually pretty proud of the fact within the Navy that we've been able to leverage a lot of our operational assets that are being used by our fleets and applying some of the mine countermeasures that they have and applying that to the UX, underwater UXO problems that we have. And it's actually exciting because, we're actually starting to see a lot of that technology make its way more into the commercial space. So things like advanced synthetic aperture, we're starting to see a lot of that technology be made more available commercially and being able to better access some of that technology and put that more into the mainstream for our stakeholders to understand as well. So I think that's promising. I think the areas where we still need to advance are really, again, understanding risk, in particular in the underwater environment, and really being able to make better decisions going forward on those sites. Sediment sites are also, a major challenge for us. The complexity of sediment sites that we often deal with, and Laura mentioned this as well, is that, we're often dealing with a very commingled nature within our sediment sites, dealing with different contaminants, different issues. And so much of our focus recently on the sediment side has been really on advancing sorting and screening technologies within our sites to really kind of segregate, some of these issues as we look to, to dispose of more cost-effective disposal of our sediments. And then the final issue that I wanted to throw in there as far as some of our bigger challenges, some of our low-risk sites. So I know, we talk a lot about some of the complex sites that we have left in the program, but we are still, in fact, dealing with a little bit of a dichotomy on this, in the sense that, many of the sites that we have remaining in the program, we essentially consider very low risk, and then that's largely some of our petroleum sites. We find ourselves having to operate systems for some time, really for the removal of very kind of thin layers of your product, and we are not able to really kind of close the books and reach response complete on these sites. And there would be nothing I'd like more than to really kind of address these sites, move forward, and really be able to focus our attention on some of the more complicated issues that we see growing in our program. Let me jump over to the next slide, Gene. Thanks. So I guess just a couple, final thoughts as I try to close this out. So You know, some of the challenges that we face, certainly, timing is a big one. You know, unfortunately, many of the needs that, you know, we're talking about today are needs that are today's needs, right? And unfortunately, we all recognize that, you know, it often takes some time to really kind of advance technology for utilization, in the mainstream. You know, I think generally, just from a validation standpoint, we've generally seen that cycle time around 3 to 4 years. You know, certainly we've seen that on the mission side. It's taken, you know, well over a decade, really, from initial, you know, lab scale work to validation to actually commercialization of much of that technology. So that is certainly a constraining factor as we move ahead. You know, at this point, we're having to rely much on vendor contractor data, which really kind of highlights the next, you know, major point is that there is a strong need for maintaining a very robust technology clearinghouse. And FRTR, you know, the technology matrix mentioned earlier, that's, you know, it's a perfect avenue for doing that. So I think there needs to be constant focus on maintaining and really updating that clearinghouse. Because that's so critically important to that really kind of this last bullet, which is the concept of having stakeholder buy-in. You know, we do things very collaboratively within the program. So it's absolutely critical that, you know, us and as well as all of our stakeholders involved in the decision-making process are really on the same page with respect to understanding, you know, the true capabilities and constraints of the technology that we can apply to our restoration issues. And so there's been a very concerted effort within DOD to do that, advancing different avenues for those discussions and conveying that information, including, you know, our involvement in ITRC, you know, our DCMO steering committee, our munitions response dialogue. And the Navy has made some very conservative efforts as well along this front with, you know, development of our OERT platform, opening up our RIT seminars so that we can have, you know, these avenues for open discussion and education on the really kind of the latest, greatest in advanced technology so that we can, you know, collectively make decisions on our sites based on that information. And again, you know, the FRTR, these discussions, this forum, you know, again, is another perfect avenue for doing that. So with that, I'll leave it there. And I just look forward to any further discussion today and going forward. Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. Our next panelist is Dr. Kent Glover, the Air Force subject matter expert for remediation systems with the Air Force Civil Engineer Center, AFCAC. Thanks, Kent.
Thank you, Greg. Dean, let's go on to the next slide, 52, I guess it is. So a lot of my message will be similar to what you just heard from Rob and Laura for the Navy and the Army, but it's slightly different as well. We have in the Air Force, we have an environmental liability that's not small. And this slide basically summarizes the magnitude of that enterprise. And we've made substantial progress, I think, in the last decade, as Rob mentioned, for the Navy, in meeting cleanup goals related to legacy contaminants, such as the chlorinated and petroleum-related organics. The number of sites requiring ongoing remedial action is much smaller than it was a decade ago. The remaining sites tend to have complex technical challenges and large costs and long tails. In recent years, in the last few years, our mission and our focus has shifted in a big way to include PFAS remediation, as it has with other agencies. The rest of this slide basically is a snapshot of where we are in the process. SIs and have pretty much been done for all of our installations. We're now starting down the path of funding remedial investigations and doing some drinking water response actions. We don't yet know the full size of the problem when it comes to how many sites are going to need actual remedial action. So sort of a two-pronged program, the legacy versus the PFAS, and we tend to think of our work in those two buckets. Let's go to slide 53. What I've done here is just listed the grand challenges in the terms of those two buckets, if you will. First, for legacy contaminants, complex sites, and as I said, progress is slow and costly because of continuing sourcing from various source areas, not active sources, but and because we have a lot of large, relatively dilute plumes that we have to somehow deal with. So specific challenges that we have with our legacy sites, because they have long tails, we do need to think about how to develop sustainable and adaptable remedies as conditions change. And so that's a challenge. As we've looked at how the remedies are going, our progress, performance of the remedies at these legacy sites, there's been a large need to optimize those remedies. The performance has come up short. And so we need to, that's a challenge. How do we optimize and how do we follow through? But a lot of the really more complex sites, there's a real need for some innovative approaches. And so how do we leverage that innovation to try and shorten those cleanup times? And where do we apply it? And those kinds of challenges. And then finally, how do we balance the cost of these long-term site cleanups against the benefits of, in terms of risk reduction and resource reuse? And I think some of the other speakers have touched on that as a challenge as well. Let's go to slide 54, please. The other big challenge, of course, is the emerging contaminants, and chemicals such as the PFAS will continue to be a focus of policy regulation and public concern, representing, as I say, a large expanding proportion of our liability. And so as we continue to characterize these sites, we need to figure out ways to develop viable site management strategies and remedial approaches in the face of evolving technical understanding of PFAS persistence, fate and transport, toxicology and risk. We need to, because of the regulatory uncertainty and uncertainty in our knowledge of the PFAS, this is really driving, I think, a need for new risk management approaches, particularly for those sites that really have not been considered remediation sites in the past. You know, how does, if we're doing a Milcon construction project at a site in face of all this uncertainty in terms of what needs to be cleaned up, how do we deal with that? How do we manage that risk? And of course, then, as several people have mentioned, we really do need to have some effective on-site treatment at full scales, large source areas, large plumes. And so that'll continue to be a challenge, I think, for the Air Force. Let's go to slide 54. And I want to, those challenges, I think, drive some specific needs for innovation and technology transfer. And I've tried to list a few of the key ones here. excuse me. To reiterate, I think what has been said before, we need some cost-effective methods for characterizing these sites. We need some full-scale treatment technologies, particularly as Laura mentioned, for low permeability, highly heterogeneous groundwater sites. Because we have relied in the last decade extremely, I think to our benefit and everyone's benefit on in-situ remedies, now we're finding that we really need to have some better tools to assess and optimize and figure out how to optimize these remedies and how to operate them longer term. we look at a lot of these in situ remedies, and it's we're kind of flying blind a lot of the time. So that's a need. As several people I think have mentioned, for characterization of PFAS, we are still in our infancy of our knowledge of how to predict fate and transport of these chemicals. So that's very much a need. And of course, then proven treatment technologies for site scale, plume scale, source scales, particularly on-site chemically destructive technologies and in situ treatment technologies. And increasingly, we're recognizing a need to look at how to efficiently and effectively treat mixtures of PFAS and legacy contaminants. 56, please. Slide 56. I think this might be my last slide, trying to remember. I wanted to pause and just introduce another challenge that we find. We have a staff, of course, of a large staff of Air Force people, civil servants and so forth, and also a large staff of contractors that work with us on these on cleanups. And we find it a challenge to continue to build and sustain their knowledge as the science evolves. And so this, I think, is a challenge going forward for technology transfer, outreach, and education. Also, as we work through, particularly it's evident, I think, at the PFAS sites, public and stakeholder understanding of increasingly complex problems, and it's a challenge to build that knowledge and to build that confidence that we have solutions to their problems. So that leads to some technology transfer needs that I've listed here, I think, that maybe FRTR can help us a lot with. Better ways to foster, particularly the upscaling and commercialization of innovative technologies that are coming out of R&D. There's a need for good long-term cost performance data at scales of sources and plumes and sites, particularly for in-situ technologies, but others as well. Much of our cost and performance data is kind of dated nowadays and goes back to largely a pump and treat era. There's, I think, a real good need for good examples, case studies, where we follow complex sites through the optimization process, and how do we, particularly success stories, but also failures, I believe, that are harder to document, but there's a real need for case studies, long-term case studies of complex sites that we can learn from to apply to other sites. We need, increasingly it's become apparent, we use models, particularly, groundwater flow and transport models at our complex sites in a variety of ways. And recently the FRTR group, in fact, had an effort to try and go out and gather up guidance on use of models. And one of the findings from that group was that there really isn't a good set of best practices or guidance or case studies on appropriate uses of models for driving and supporting remedial decisions made by RPMs and that kind of thing. So that's, particularly at our complex sites and long-term sites, that's an increasing technology transfer need. And finally, then, how do we get this complex knowledge out to the public, and are there things that FRTR can help us with there? I believe at this point that's the end of my slides, isn't it? And Greg, I'll turn it back to you.
Yes. Thanks, Kent. Next, I am pleased to announce the next panelist, Mark Gilbertson, who is Associate Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for Regulatory and Policy Affairs with the Office of Environmental Management at the U.S. Department of Energy, DOE.
Thank you, Greg. Next slide. So I'll talk a little bit about the EM mission, because not everybody may be aware of it. But so what we're about in the Department of Energy's EM mission is about cleaning up the environmental legacy that was brought on from decades of nuclear weapons development and government-sponsored nuclear research. And so it started, you know, back in with the Manhattan Project in 1942. And, you know, our EM program was created in 1989, and it is not a coincidence that, you know, 1 year later, you know, FRTR was created. I think we recognized early on the need to partner across federal agencies to do this, and have been a big supporter of the important work that this organization does. And we hope that and will continue to support a future role for this, because I think you're hearing a theme of needs that we have going into the future, where we need to work together. Our program is the largest environmental liability in the country right now. If you kind of project out over the next 10 years, the costs for executing our program are on the order of $70 billion to execute. The majority of that funding is in areas that is a little bit different than what's been talked about to date. We focus a large amount of our efforts on radioactive tank waste stabilization, treatment, and disposal. That kind of going out into the future for the next 10 years is going to be about $28 billion worth of effort. Our spent nuclear fuel and nuclear materials management and disposition is another large part of our program. That's about $6 billion worth of work over the next 10 years. And our transuranic and mixed low-level waste disposition, you know, is about $8 billion worth of work going out over the next 10 years period of time. I think a key thing to keep in mind, though, is even though you say, well, how is that related to a lot of our problems related to soil and groundwater? You know, the pathway for exposure to the public for most of these radiologic materials is through into the soil, into groundwater, and to the public. So soils and groundwater remediation is a big part of our program too. And so over this next period of time, we have about $3.5 billion worth of work that we're going to continue to do in that area. Since that 1989 timeframe, you know, we've made progress. You know, we completed cleanup at 91 of the 107, you know, major nuclear weapons and nuclear research sites. Most of those completed cleanups are now being monitored by our sister office in the Department of Energy, the Office of Legacy Management, to ensure that those cleanups are performing in the way that we had designed them. You know, the remaining cleanups that we have at several of our sites are very complex and with both heavy metals, rad, and organic kind of contaminants that we're dealing with at these sites. So next slide. I'm going to kind of push it in a little bit of different direction, because I think that we as a group also need to kind of think, you know, kind of revolutionary versus evolutionary. And I know that as we go forward, one of the things that we're talking about in the Department of Energy with regard to tackling a lot of our problems, not just in the environmental area, but in the energy kind of arena, and with the weapons production side of the house and basic sciences, you know, how can we utilize artificial intelligence and machine learning in our processes to move forward so that we're driving science-based decision-making? And I add that layer on top of all of the needs that have been identified by the previous speakers, and I'm sure will be identified by the speakers that come after me, because, you know, we have common problems and things that we need to address is the climate resiliency, the contaminant movement, long-term monitoring, and how we, in a responsible way, exit pump and treat systems, the historic ones. Next slide, please. So one of the things that faces us, seeing the major part of the AM program now, is focused on very complex sites. A site like Hanford is our largest site and our largest liability. That site alone in the next 10 years period of time will probably expend about $26 billion at that site trying to deal with the environmental legacy that was left there. And so we need to kind of look at things in a totality, look across. You know, we have a tendency with regard to our frameworks and how we tackle problems that we're going to look within solid waste management units and we're going to move from one to the next and move forward. But, you know, as we approach a site that's this complex with this many different kind of contaminants, they're moving in different ways through the environment, it behooves us to try and look at it in a little bit different framework, you know, because you probably don't optimize the taxpayers' investment to reduce risk by, you know, looking in the stovepipes through a strict regulatory framework. Next slide. So we too are interested in PFAS and emerging as an emerging contaminant. It's not important to us, but what I will stress is it just because we haven't used it as much at our sites. I will stress, though, that we really value this group as a potential resource for us to speak with the public to, from a technical perspective, move forward with a common approach across the federal agencies, because I think, you know, that if everybody does it their own way, I think that we'll be very inefficient as we move forward with activities. So I'm excited about the potential for what FRTR can do with regard to the characterization, the remediation of PFAS contamination moving in forward, so we can kind of learn some of our lessons in the past to move forward into the future. Next slide. So one of the other things that we have tapped into in our organization, we have the benefit of the National Lab, DOE National Lab system. In most of the sites that we have large complex remaining work to be done at is co-located with the Department of Energy National Labs. And so we've leveraged them to in an innovative way to look at our particular problems and sites for how we might do things differently going into the future. We've got a lot of work that's been done. They've reviewed our technology program. They're involved with helping to guide us into the future at several of these sites. I encourage you, for those of you that are tackling similar kind of things, to please reach out and work with us so that we can jointly tackle some of these issues and set priorities for the future as a common kind of federal group. And I'll stop there and let the next speaker, let Mark talk about nuclear stuff.
Thanks, Mark. Our next panelist is another Mark Thagard, Director of the Division of Risk Analysis with the Office of Nuclear Regulatory Research at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, NRC.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. It's my pleasure to be part of this panel discussion this afternoon. Can I have the next slide? So the NRC is responsible for regulating the civilian application of nuclear technology. We license a wide range of activities, including nuclear power generation, nuclear material use and disposal, and transportation and storage of nuclear material. Unlike probably most of the other members of the panel, we're not actually responsible for carrying out remediation, but we oversee the remediation of sites that we license. Because on our current requirements, before a licensee can terminate their license, they have to demonstrate that the residual radioactivity at the site is not going to cause a member of the public to receive a radiation dose above our regulatory limits. And so we have a range of sites undergoing decommissioning. These include nuclear power plants and former manufacturing facilities that use radioactivity as part of their process. So it's just a wide range of different type of sites. And similar to DOE, most of our remediation activity involved radioactive contaminants. That's our primary focus area. Can I have the next slide? So just to go over some of the challenges that we have, and they're slightly different than I think some of the other challenges that were posed, but there may be some commonality too. One of the challenges is we have the evaluation of the application of new technologies for remediation of residual radiological contamination. You know, because we're as part of our remediation, we're looking at terminating the license of these sites. The licensee needs to be able to walk away from the site. So if we have, we're starting to see some licensees come in with novel approaches for meeting our requirements, such as, you know, in situ. So if you're gonna leave radioactivity at the site, you have to be able to show that it's not going to move in the future, and so that poses some challenges. Another challenge is, and I think this was kind of touched upon earlier, is the adoption of a federal agency-wide radiological survey approach and protocol for remediation of subsurface contamination. For example, when you have contamination where you can't rely on radiation surveys at the surface, trying to come up with an approach to analyze the appropriate number of samples to collect to show that you've actually cleaned up the site is a bit of a challenge. Another challenge is assessing the long-term performance of remediation programs at some of our uranium extraction sites. These are primarily DOE sites, and we're starting to look into some issues in terms of the performance of some of the engineer covers at the for some of the mill tailing sites. Another challenge is establishing appropriate consensus-based guidance for developing conceptual site models for sites with complex hydrogeology. I think this has been touched upon by nearly everyone. So we have also some sites undergoing remediation that have fairly complex hydrogeology, and trying to come up with a way to develop a acceptable conceptual model, site conceptual model, you know, it becomes a bit of a challenge. And then the last challenge I just want to mention is ensuring effective collaboration and coordination with other federal and state agencies on lessons learned at challenging remediation sites. Multiple agencies may be involved in some of the sites that we're dealing with, and these different agencies have their different sets of issues that they're dealing with, and potentially different remediation goals. So there's a need for coordination. Can I have the next slide? So I was kind of brief, so that may make up some time. But I did want to, before ending, I did want to say a couple of things of appreciation. So the NRC staff greatly appreciate the collaborative work of the FRTR Steering Committee, and the technical partnership with the DOE to organize and coordinate numerous FRTR meetings focusing on remediation cleanup of cleanup sites containing radionuclides. I think the NRC and DOE are probably the two agencies primarily involved with radioactive contamination. And we look forward to continuing to work with the FRTR in identifying and applying innovative technologies. So that's it for me. So I turn it to the next speaker.
Thanks, Mark. Next, we'll hear from Dr. Jeff Plumling, Chief Scientist of the U.S. Geological Survey.
Great. Well, thanks very much. I really have appreciated the presentations that have gone before. You'll probably hear a lot of the same kind of messages. Next slide, please. So for those of you that don't know, the USGS is a non-regulatory, non-advocacy science and scientific agency that provides information and our science to inform policy and decision-making on a very wide range of topics. And from a remediation standpoint, we actually don't do site remediation as best as I have learned throughout my career, both as a researcher and then more recently as a senior leader. What we do is we provide the interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary science that can help inform site remediation, also prioritization of which sites need to be cleaned up, for example. So we do interdisciplinary earth and biological system science work. One of the things that we do bring in addition to sort of the standard geochemical, hydrogeological characterization, we can also provide a hazards, natural hazards characterization to understand how natural hazards like potential for landslides, earthquakes, things like that might influence site remediation. Next slide. So our science, our interdisciplinary science is aligned along five different theme-based mission areas. And the science that we provide to assist in remediation is spread across all of the different mission areas, remote sensing, geologic mapping in the first, ecosystems, look at effects on fish, wildlife. We also do environmental contaminants and pathogens and their impacts on fish and wildlife and their implications for human health. Energy and minerals has a big component of environmental issues, really looking at a holistic context of energy and mineral resources with what are the environmental implications, how best to use geologic information to inform cleanup. Natural hazards, as I indicated, provides information on potential vulnerability of sites to various natural hazards. And then, of course, our water mission area, looking at water availability, meaning water quantity and water quality. Hydrologic, hydrogeologic modeling, hydrogeochemical modeling, or active transport modeling of sites. Next slide, please. So there are a number of different challenges, and these, I would say, are technical challenges. And I neglected to put on the slides that we, too, are very, very happy to see the current administration's emphasis on science to inform tribal and underserved communities. And in very many cases, those are communities that are affected by substantial remediation challenges. So we are fully supportive of that and have had a lot of activity over the years working on that. So from these technical challenges, for example, how do we better characterize emerging yet to be discovered contaminants and pathogens? What can we do to help monitor the remediation efficacy? I'll talk about abandoned mines in the context of the photo on the right, but I'll first talk about the remediation challenges. So how do we characterize and understand sites with complex hydrogeology and geochemistry? We need to look at it in a watershed context. We can't just look at the site itself in many cases. What are the potential impacts of climate change? You've seen that in previous discussions. How can we increase providing science that helps enhance the utility and simplification of remediation? And then how do we deal with waters that have had very complex mixtures of multiple contaminant classes? Now, I wanted to talk just briefly about the photo on the left. That actually is a photo of Red Mountain Pass that my dad took in 1962. That's the Iderado mine complex. There's been a lot of remediation that's gone on there, but this is a good example of an abandoned mine lands watershed where you have not only multiple mine sites with multiple workings that may underground workings or open pits that may be fluidic water quality, mine waste piles, tailings that when rained upon released pulses of acid metals. But in the background, you can see Red Mountain. Red Mountain is a naturally mineralized area that is contributing very substantial quantities of natural acid rock drainage. So how do you best understand a site in an integrated geologic, hydrologic, geochemical, ecological, topographical, climate, et cetera, context? Iderado has been pretty heavily remediated. I think the picture would look very different if you photographed it in the present day. Next slide. So technology needs, you've heard a lot of these as well, and I'll let people look through the slide or put it on pause when they're looking at the recording. But how can we separate neutral valent compounds, pesticides, pharmaceuticals in a cost-effective way? We're looking more and more to what can we do to develop both in situ and remotely sensed advanced sensor technologies to look at multiple classes of contaminants and pathogens in real time. And what can we do to help develop treatment schemes for multiple classes of contaminants that grow from our knowledge of natural geochemical processes and how particular contaminant classes respond in the environment and in waters. Research gaps. I should have included a lot more on PFAS, not just the PFAS degrading microbes, but developing the analytical methods for both targeted and non-targeted for the thousands of different compounds that could be in this class. And what is their toxicity to fish, wildlife, and what are their toxicity implications for humans? The USGS is going to have a science strategy on an interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary approach for dealing with PFAS that will be coming out within the next few weeks, I hope. Machine learning, artificial intelligence, improved conceptual site models that integrate a lot of different scientific methodologies and expertise, better sampling analytical methodologies, and better predictive models of plausible impacts given a range of future climate conditions on the sites that are being remediated. Next slide. So that's a quick overview of the USGS. Thanks.
Thanks, Jeff. Our final panelist is William Sook, PhD, MPH. Bill's the director of both the Superfund Research Program, SRP, and the Hazardous Substances Research Branch in the Division of Extramural Research and Training at the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, NIEHS.
Hello.
We can hear you loud and clear.
Yep, we can hear you.
What?
Am I on mute?
No, you're unmuted.
We can hear you fine, Bill.
Exactly.
Okay, cool. Okay, well, greetings from Gallup, New Mexico. it just happens to be where I am today on vacation. But anyway, thank you very much for this invitation to participate in today's discussion with all these panelists. It's been an interesting discussion thus far. So the Superfund Research Program has been a part of the FRTR Steering Committee for about 6 years. Heather Henry, who you know very, very well, has been the lead for this and has given us an opportunity here, because this forum has given us a valuable insight into understanding the challenges and opportunity in remediation of complex hazardous substances in the environment. So we really do appreciate the opportunity to be a part of this roundtable. Next slide, please. I can't see them, so you're going to tell me that they're up.
It's up. Go ahead, Bill.
Thank you. So the Superfund research program was created under the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act, SARA, which call for hazardous substances basic research and training program. And it was housed, it's housed and has been housed at NIEHS, which is an institute of NIH, since that time. The SRP is a multi-interdisciplinary research program, research and training program, that centers on four mandates addressing health effects, assessing risk, detection and remediation of hazardous substances. They're in front of you right here, but just to emphasize one thing with regards to a university-based basic research program that was established some time ago. The intent was to get academic researchers to address each of these four mandates in one way or another. Advanced techniques for the detection, assessment, and evaluation of human health effects of hazardous substances, methods to assess the risk to human health presented by hazardous substances, methods and technologies to detect hazardous substances in the environment, basic biological, chemical, and physical methods to reduce the amount and technical toxicity of hazardous substances. I'm emphasizing hazardous substances because nowhere in our legislation does it mention anything about hazardous waste. It gives us a much broader mandate because it uses the word hazardous substances. Also, it specifically directs us not to be a site-specific program. That doesn't mean that people don't work on sites, and doesn't mean that people don't do things with regards to those sites, but we are not a site-specific program. Next slide, please. So the mission is to provide practical science to solutions to protect human health. Building on our mandates, the mission, as I mentioned, is to provide practical science to solutions to protect human health and aims to understand and reduce exposures to potentially harmful contaminants and, again, improve health. Remember, we're part of NIH. The program is a peer-reviewed, competitively awarded grants program. It uses the NIH peer review system, which is a tough system, and has been central to the rise of American science in the past half century. It encourages and supports excellent scientists and draws some of the nation's best minds to focus on complex problems, in this case, relevant to reducing hazardous substances. So the SRP's 2020 strategic plan was released last summer, and it emphasized the importance of a quote-unquote systems approach to bring together diverse disciplines, health researchers, engineers, biologists, ecologists, molecular biologists, earth scientists, data scientists and experts, and social scientists. The SRP believes inviting multiple perspectives to the table to understand the system in which the problem exists is the best way to find multi-sectional solutions. 2 days ago, later on I'll mention we do a series called Risky Learning, and we've been doing it for a number of years in collaboration with our colleagues at EPA. Using their Kluwen system. And the intent here of data science is to be able to look at different data platforms and look at the interoperability of these platforms so that you can answer questions that cannot be answered by one research area alone. And as part of NIH, we are working closely with all partners, EPA, ATSDR, DOE, USGS, et cetera, as well as communities living near sites impacted by hazardous substances, as well as tribal nations and U.S. state agencies. The program is better able to deliver solutions to hazardous substance problems. Next slide, please. So the SRP has several funding mechanisms. What you see here is actually a picture of the United States, obviously, with the different research awards that we've made over time. The cornerstone of the SRP is the multi-project centers. They are designed for integration across disciplines and include projects from different disciplines focused on addressing common problems that are essentially the theme of that particular center or centers. These centers are an excellent resource for groups like the FRTR. They are at the front line of toxicology research, which is the basis for remediation decisions. They are developing novel, sustainable technologies to remediate sites, and in many cases are working alongside federal agency staff at sites in need of novel approaches. In addition, these centers include CORE's expertise in research translation and community engagements, which are required within each center, who are working in hundreds of communities throughout the nation. I also want to point out we have other mechanisms that we provide support. Our individual research program, R01s, have been focusing for a long time on remediation technologies. We have a very unique mandate, as I pointed out, the mandates. The fourth mandate is the only mandate that requires us to support research in remediation and those kinds of research. It is definitely unique to NIH. No other organization at NIH supports that kind of research, and we have an R01 program dedicated to it. And we also have a SBIR program, and we also have occupational training, which supports emerging technologies as well. That's an R25 program. NIH has many, many mechanisms, and we try to take full advantage of each one of them. Needless to say, the network of research and activities of the SRP brings much to the table for the FRTR working groups and its member agencies. I think that's an important comment to make. Next slide, please. In our 35 years as a research program, we have conducted work at hundreds of hazardous waste sites, produced thousands of peer-reviewed publications and patents. We have supported the cross-disciplinary training of environmental health professionals, many of whom are now working in the FRTR member agencies. Lastly, the basic research we fund leads to significant cost savings in remediation practices. We also have challenges, and despite progress that has been made in many areas, there are issues that are getting more attention in the next 10 years that have to be addressed. Environmental justice and environmental health disparities, a topic that is a very high priority for all of NIH. Climate change and disaster response, including resilience of communities and robustness of remediation strategies, multiple stressors, aka mixtures, remain a vexing problem in toxicology and in treatment remedies. Emerging contaminants, there's been a lot of discussion about PFAS as an example, and the need to be proactive about identifying them and doing something about them before they become more of a significant problem. Data sharing, mentioned a second ago about the Risky Learning seminar series that we did the other day, is becoming more sophisticated in the health sciences, but frankly is lagging behind in the environmental sciences. And this program is trying to bring those two broad data sharing opportunities forward, because these are the types of research that we support. And lastly, it remains a challenge for new remediation technology to overcome the quote-unquote the valley of death to make it to field implementation. These are all challenges that we need to be able to look at and be able to actually do something about. And hopefully this strategic planning activity, of these working groups will be able to help that. Next slide, please. So with all that, I would like to thank you for your attention. But here I have provided you a variety of links to learn more about our program. I encourage you to check out the various components of our website to learn more about our program and initiatives and upcoming events. There are a number of them here. We do a Science Digest. The research briefs are really, really very good. The risky learning is something that we've been doing for a number of years and is always been very well attended. We have different subject areas. We have a listing of who we fund, so you might want to take a look at that and see whether or not there's any collaborations that can be enhanced. So I mentioned I mentioned a couple of times the Risky Learning series we held one the other day, and the title is up there. Look at the next one. The next one is on June 3rd, next week, or in 2 weeks, June 18th. And it's enhancing integration, interoperability, and reuse of data. There's a lot going on. And I do think that there are areas that we can help and assist. Again, we are part of NIH, and we are both fundamental in all the research that we support. But we have to figure out ways and come up with creative ways in order to move these tools, these technologies, into the field in a more deliberate way. With that, I want to thank you, and thank you again. Bye-bye.
So. Hey, thanks, Bill, and thanks all panelists. I'll turn it back to Jean right now for instructions as we go into a short break.
So with that time, I'm going to go ahead and close down our meeting chat as well. So I'll remind our attendees, please continue to use that Q&A window to privately submit any comments or questions or technical issues you might be encountering. And I'll go ahead and hide these slides and turn it over to you, Greg, to get things started.
Thanks, Jean. Thanks to everybody for coming back after the break. I think our high watermark, we were over 300 people connected and we're still around 250. That's fantastic. We have a little bit of time for a few questions, and so we'll go ahead and get to those now. First question, and I'll ask that Kent Glover from the Air Force help us out with this one. Recent advances in high-resolution site characterization, and hold on, my computer's glitching here. Of course, the wrong time. All right, here we go again. Recent advances in high-resolution site characterization technologies and methods are providing new insights for CSMs at complex sites, such as characterization of migration pathways, contaminant mass fraction, and other conditions that can be important in selecting, designing, and optimizing remediation approaches. However, HRSC technologies are not without cost, particularly if deployed throughout a large source area, plumes, and sites. So here's the question. Within your agency, how are high-res technologies gaining acceptance and use? How does your agency balance the costs and benefits of high-res at the scales of specific remediation systems like biowalls, source areas, and groundwater plumes?
Okay, thanks, Greg. A couple of thoughts. I guess the first thought is that, for the past 10 years or so, the Air Force has been heavily invested in performance-based contracting. We rely on contractors a lot to do the work at the sites, and how we set up those objectives in the contracts, it becomes real important. So in the course of these performance-based contracts over the last decade, we've done, as a number of agencies have done, remedy evaluations of performance and effectiveness and that kind of thing. And in study after study after study, we've learned a lot of things, but the number one thing we always do learn is that efforts to that the performance is oftentimes hindered by a lack of specificity and detail in the conceptual site model at the scale of the remedy, as opposed to, say, at the scale of the site. And oftentimes CSMs that give short change to key processes, key controls on contaminant migration, back diffusion, whatever the process might be. And so that's where the high resolution characterization tools are really and methods are really useful, is in trying to refine those conceptual site models. So I think that's clear to a number of agencies that are in the roundtable. Recently, what we've done in our contracting approach, which is one way of rolling out high-res work, is we've, for those complex sites where remedies have stalled and there's a clear need to improve the conceptual site model, we've focused the performance objectives of the contracts specifically on improving those CSMs rather than enhancing the performance of the remedy. You know, that involves a contractor putting together work plans and what have you. But clearly, the intent is to implement for a substantial number of sites that are perhaps our most expensive and long term. That forces our contracting. It aligns our contracting with the need to improve our CSM through high resolution techniques. So that's one thought of how we go about it. The other thing we have done through our BAA demonstration validation projects that we have, it's a small effort, but a meaningful effort, is we have funded a few projects specifically to implement high resolution technologies in an effort to improve objectives, the performance objectives for those larger, longer term contracts. And more importantly, one project in particular where we asked it was CDM Smith that just recently finished the work, and they've come up with a really nice guidance manual, a compendium of tools and methods, and a little Excel spreadsheet tool to help people from a DQO perspective in planning and selecting high resolution tools and methods. You can't just use that spreadsheet blindly. You still have to know the site and use the evaluate the information and so forth. But I think that project in particular is sort of a key project for us as we roll it out now through training internally right now, but also, it was scheduled for a training session at the Patel conference that recently got canceled. And I'm sure that we'll want to do that again. And so we're starting to roll that guidance and methodology out to our contractors and consulting firms and so forth that we work with through a variety of venues. But really, you know, the second half of the question was how do we balance cost and benefit, right? And that is a challenge, and I think is continuing to be a challenge, and it's something we hope to learn better how to do from the other member agencies of this roundtable, for example. I don't think we really have a good way to quantify cost versus benefit of the high resolution technologies. We'd like to, I think case studies would go a long way in helping us understand what high resolution approaches prove most effective in what types of sites, and following those efforts through into subsequent remedy optimization efforts. That's a couple thoughts anyways, and I don't know, maybe somebody else on the panel has an additional idea or thought.
Let's quickly see if there's an additional thought on the panel, then I definitely want to move on to another couple of questions in the 10 minutes we have left. And that's such a great topic, and I know the FRTR has a lot of rich content and experience bringing high res to the table in these venues, so we look forward to more of that in the future. Next question. Given over 40 years of cleanup work, are there any efforts within the federal agencies to do data mining to assess how quickly we can achieve restoration of groundwater depending on site characteristics and technologies applied? And that was an audience question. Thank you for submitting that. On a related note, I'd also ask the panelists if they have any thoughts in that realm or another related to the role of artificial intelligence and machine learning to the remediation practice. And I'll ask Mark Gilbertson from DOE to kick us off.
Yeah, so what people might not realize is in, you know, the Department of Energy is using AI and machine learning in some of the climate change modeling that's going on within the departments at the national laboratories. The data that was used to develop the subsurface kind of components of those climate change models, or was data that was generated from our well of characterized studied sites over time. And, you know, for example, one of the things they're looking at is how stable will the ice sheets be, you know, in the Antarctic over the next 40 years, water cycles, precipitation, rainfall patterns, drought. Well, doesn't that kind of sound like climate change? And what we want to look at with regard to the resiliency of you know, our remediation solutions. So I think that you know, what we need to get in is, and I think this is a very good forum to kind of show that there is some common needs across all of the programs in the country with regard to tackling these kind of questions and situations with regard to using AI and machine learning for these kind of activities, and make it a contact sport with the science folks that are tackling some of these things so that we can leverage the advances they're making with regard to the climate change modeling to say we want to look at it, as was discussed before, on a watershed basis and maybe do some pilots, you know, for that so we can make better decisions going into the future with regard to some of those remedies. I think that could be you know, an area that the roundtable could, you know, kind of champion and look into the art of the possibilities going into the future, because the work is going on. You know, another example of you know, a parallel thing is just the way that artificial intelligence and machine learning is being used to drive cars. You know, on how you get cars to run. Well, so if you start to think about, you know, our remediation technologies and using a suite of them on particular problems, you know, maybe we can leverage the investments that are being made in these other areas with regard to the structural code and the structure of creating these decision-making kind of efforts. Maybe we can leverage that in our remediation world as we go forward and leverage those investments for something that we as a collective group see as a long-term need for the country. Just something to think about.
Thanks, Mark. Any other thoughts on data mining, AI, machine learning from the other panelists?
I'll just quickly mention, you know, many of us have large databases, historical data at sites, and so the opportunity to mine data is there. I think the challenge is more in once you plot up those time trends or however you do it, the challenge is in understanding what that means in terms of how it relates to what was done at the site. Right. And what little we have done, it's confusing. It's not always immediately clear why long-term trends result in cleanup or don't. At some sites, we've found it to be a very useful indicator of time to clean up for sites that are controlled by back diffusion, say, or that kind of thing. At other sites, it gets complicated because the remedy itself keeps changing, you know, and there isn't a long-term consistency in the remedy or a steady trend of optimization of a particular remedy. So there's a lot of data out there. There's certainly opportunity.
Appreciate that, Kent. So let's move on to another question. And I as time permits, I think there's an opportunity for all the panelists to weigh in on this one. And this comes from the FRTR Agency Leadership Survey that was administered over the last month. The challenges identified training new personnel, including project managers, as both a challenge and a need. Additionally, we continue to lose decades of knowledge and expertise out the door to retirements among our practitioner community. Here's the question. How is your agency taking on this challenge? How can the FRTR support your work in this area? And I'd ask Dana Stalka from EPA to kick us off.
Thanks, Greg. First of all, one of the things when I joined the program that I really appreciated is leaders like Greg, like Dan Powell, who's not able to join us today, and seeing the importance of not only the development of the technologies, but also the transfer of that information. And we've always had a very major emphasis within USREADY in terms of the training. And we continue to look at that. We've done things like legacy learning. As people have walked out, we've videotaped them talking about, and very often it's, you know, programmatic things, but it's also technologies and what's worked. We still continue to invest a lot of time and effort, resources in CLUIN. We're continuing NARPM. It's been virtual. I think most of you are familiar with our major training event that we do with our remedial project managers. We've been doing it virtually. We still hold out hope to do one in person soon. We had already done quite a bit of work on virtual training, but we're getting better at it through the last year with the pandemic, which is important. I think we also continue to find other ways to make sure that our RPMs know what's going on. The technologies are not useful unless the people that need them have access to them. So with our recent Superfund task force work the last few years, we emphasized trying to get the information out to our RPMs more effectively. We worked with our Office of Research and Development on their C-STARS program and our tech hub to have the kind of a desktop ability for our RPMs to know what's out there. And we've continued to put out technology fact sheets. I mean, sometimes these are things that they might not appear to be quite as innovative, but just combining, you know, for instance, activated carbon with some other amendments in certain situations and putting that together and then getting that out through our fact sheets and our various outreach. So these are some things we're doing, and, you know, we certainly look forward to working with the FRTR sister agencies on any ways to combine efforts. I think you're muted, Greg.
Greg. Laura, you're the environmental cleanup practice lead for the Army Corps of Engineers. What are some thoughts that you have on this?
Yeah, no, thanks, Greg. I appreciate it. So as you mentioned, not only do I manage the business line, but I'm also the chief for our community of practice, which is over 4,000 environmental professionals in the Corps of Engineers. That's over 10% of our workforce has some role to play in environmental work. So we have a pretty robust program with our career program 18, which is not just environmental work. It's actually all our engineer and construction scientists in the Army. And we have career maps that are very deliberate from the time that you graduate from college until you reach my level. And if you look at how I went about, I followed the career map pretty closely. And I think we've been really able to leverage the last 14 months to take what are pretty robust training programs for some of our turnkey cleanup programs, like the formerly used defense sites program, and take those trainings online. And so most of our cleanup folks are working multiple programs. And I think we're able to leverage the FUDS program, the FUSRAP program, and the other training that we do for those turnkey programs and really train our professionals from the time that we bring them on as journeymen all the way through to this level. And I think that's actually one of the good things that have come out of COVID is we were able to bring people on details virtually now to the headquarters, to our major subordinate commands, and they can see all the different levels of policy. It's really forced us in a good way to work across generations in our workforce and really do that legacy planning.
Thanks, Laura. And yeah, we are about at the end of our time. I wanted to check to see if any of the other panelists had remarks related to this. I see some meats coming off right now.
So one thing I'll just point out too is I think that this is an opportunity also to bring in the next generation of workers. And the thing about it is, so we're trying to increase and stress more our are programs that we have with minority serving institutions. And so we have connections across the country where we're bringing in students to do research, students to do internships, students to work from these institutions at our cleanup sites and at our national laboratories. And so I think it is really an opportunity kind of for a twofer to have our workforce of the future more look more like the rest of the country.
Mark, thanks.
Yep. Hey, Greg, this is Rob. Just one other point to add, you know, like Laura and Dana mentioned, you know, when we look at managing a program from a program management perspective, actually managing our workforce is critical and central to that. And we're, like Dana and Laura, are pretty proud of the fact that we've been able to have that formalized training and move that into a much more virtual environment, you know, through this past year. And, you know, I think to add to that, you know, I think having more ad hoc resources, you know, some of the avenues and venues that I talked about a little earlier, including our OER2 and our RIT, I think there's importance in also extending those opportunities beyond just Navy personnel and having that available to our stakeholders and our partners as well. I mean, I think it's you know, this whole idea of having a collaborative effort, making sure that we're all on the same page, again, with respect to, you know, capabilities, constraints with on technologies, you know, all helps us move forward in the same direction. So,
perfect.
Yeah.
Jeff, as the chief scientist for the USGS, do you have some parting thoughts, particularly as it relates to our demand for STEM talent in this arena?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I was actually going to put that in the, you could see me typing, I was going to put that in the chat. But so one thing that we've been very pleased to see is the administration, current administration support for this Climate Conservation Corps. And we actually would love to see a Climate Science Corps, and you could broaden it to include a lot of aspects that would bring in site remediation, things like that under current climate conditions, or can just broaden it in general. But what can we do to help rebuild the workforce, and also that, so that, as the previous person said, more better reflects the diversity of the population, but also create the next generation of climate scientists, remediation scientists, and engineers that will not only help us rebuild expertise that we've lost due to retirements and things like that, but also how can we bring in the people with the expertise that have for things like AI, ML, advanced computing, advanced modeling, or system predictability, uncertainty, that we really need to be addressing these really substantial challenges facing not only from climate's perspective, but remediation and many other areas that require an integrated science approach. So thanks.
Thanks, Jeff. Mark T. from Nuclear Regulatory Commission, your agency occupies a really unique and important space. I wanted to make sure you had an opportunity to weigh in on this as well before we turn it back over to Heather.
Yeah, thank you. So I'll just be brief. So one thing that we are doing, I mean, we're doing some of the same things, some of the other that's already been mentioned, but one thing I think that hasn't been mentioned is, so we have a very active knowledge management program. We, in fact, we have a full-time person responsible for running that program, and we have a what we call a Wikipedia, well, we call it Nuclearpedia, which we use pretty actively, where we put in articles and, you know, give people the opportunity to put in different type of you know, information sharing type thing. So that's one thing I think that, you know, I just want to bring up. So.
Great. Thanks for that. So I know we've gone even a little bit past our time, so I'll thank the panelists for such a great afternoon. And I'm going to turn it over to Heather Henry from NIEHS. She'll close us out with a summary as well as set us up for session two for next week.
Thank you, Greg, and I'd also like to sincerely thank our panelists for taking the time to present your points of view today about the remediation challenges. Very engaged discussion and excellent questions from the audience. any questions that came up that we weren't able to answer today, we will definitely follow up at a later date. So we appreciate your patience with that. Next slide, please. And this has been mentioned before, but we definitely are interested in your thoughts. So meaning the audience participants, we have the two questions that we posed today, the grand challenges and the technology needs and research gaps. And then if you put the next slide on, it's a little sneak peek to what we'll be talking about next week. We also welcome your responses to the other three questions that were on the survey to the senior leaders of the FRTR member groups. Advancing new technologies, some, what are the barriers? What are the incentives that could be out there? Any promising new technologies, initiatives and coordinations that are that you're aware of, or resources and such that would be helpful for FRTR as we coordinate our activities? And then also a future vision for the FRTR. And I must say, we've been getting some great questions and comments already along these lines through the Q&A. And so hope to see that continue to come in. If you would, because we are using the input we get for, you know, developing next directions, we do ask that you can send your responses by May 31st and give us a better chance of being able to incorporate that. And the FRTR at emsus.com is the address to send it to. This will be posted on the webinar page, so the questions and this email address will be there for your reference. And then last slide, if you would, Jean. So next week is part two of Grand Challenges and Opportunities for Advancing Remediation Technologies, where we will be featuring the remediation research program part of some of the same member agencies who we heard from today. And so that's next week, same time, 1 p.m. Eastern till about 3:30. And encourage you to register. There are still slots open. So with that, Jean, I will pass it back to you for closing thoughts.
All right. Thank you so very much, Heather. I know we're just a few moments past our scheduled end time, but let me walk through just a few final reminders. I know some of our speakers highlighted the Cleanup Information Network or CLUIN website, so I just wanted to remind everyone you can visit us at cluin.org to learn more about some of the resources, ongoing webinar series, and other tech transfer initiatives. I also do send out our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, on the first of each month, so I encourage you to visit us there and subscribe so that you can get a delivery right to your own inbox when webinars like today's session are made available. For those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation material, information about our presenters, all of that content is already posted on the seminar homepage. So I've put that in the meeting chat earlier today, but it's also up here on this slide. And this page will be active from today forward. So if you are one of the lucky ones replaying today's recorded session, you can still go to that URL to access the same materials. I'll just point out there were a few people who were looking for copies of the individual panelist slides. And just for clarification, we actually combined them into one agency panel presentation deck. So all presentation slides have been posted. They may just not be listed by individual panelists. But if you have any problems locating slides that were shown today, please feel free to reach out to me directly. One of the most common questions I get is if we offer CEUs or PDHs. And while I am sad to say that I cannot issue those types of credit hours, I can provide you with a participation certificate if you fill out the feedback form for today's session. So when you visit the seminar homepage, look for that feedback form tab. I'll be emailing that out in a follow-on email as well, as Heather noted. I also put it in the meeting chat earlier today. The one thing I will point out, you need to check a box at the bottom of that form certifying you were here for the whole thing or you replayed the entire archive in order for a certificate to be generated. So just make sure you fill that form out completely, check the box at the bottom, and then as soon as you submit it, you'll have that certificate for your own records. So I want to echo the session organizers and panelists for their thanks for each and every one of you for joining us. As noted, we had well over 300 attendees join us for today's live broadcast. And I hope that all of you will be coming back next week when we carry on with session two and can invite some of your friends to join us for that live delivery. So with that, I'll go ahead and wrap things.